Welcome to the Recruiter Startup Podcast. My name's Dolta Doherty, and in this podcast series, I will be interviewing advisors, investors, founders, thought leaders, and recruiters who are living all around the world in how to set up, scale, and operate a world-class recruitment company. We are in for a treat today. I have just interviewed Toby Bapp of Harrington Star, and it was fantastic. So we got to go through how he managed to set up his business, scale it, move it to America, as well as scale domestically. He's a great guy, knows his stuff inside out, and is passionate about changing the image of the industry whilst making his business the market leader in his space. I really enjoyed this interview, and if you're a young founder and you're thinking, how am I going to structure things? How will I do it? I think Toby's simple way is what you want to emulate. He's taken the good and got rid of some of the bad of a lot of his previous experiences, and he's created something that's a bit special. All right, over to Toby. Let me know what you think. And as ever, reach out to me anytime. Toby Bapp, how are you on this lovely day?
I am doing very well indeed, thank you. Very well indeed.
Welcome to Recruiter Startup Podcast. We are delighted to have you.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thanks, and well done. I think it's a great initiative that you're doing, and lovely to be a part of it.
Oh, well, thank you for your kind words. as I mentioned briefly, I have stolen a few ideas from you in a couple of these interviews, so I have to own up to that straight off.
You are more than welcome to them.
Deadly. Okay, so I have given people a quick rundown into your background, but... Mm-hmm. Why don't you elaborate to begin with and let us know how you got into this weird and wonderful world of highs and lows, winning and losing, that is agency recruitment.
Do you know what? I wish it was a more innovative and unique story than falling into it, which I think is where most of us go. I wish I could say I used to dress up as a recruiter as a kid and all that sort of thing, and it was destined for, forever. But As usual, it was someone who got into it. I used to work in an event business, and the guy who was working with us in there left the warehouse. He was basically a warehouse guy in the event. He used to put all the bungee runs in the back of the van for us, and I was the head of sales. And he managed to get himself a job at Huxley Associates over in the S3 group. And I met up with him a couple of months afterwards, and he started telling me about what people were earning. And I said, well, look, it might be about time that I started doing that. I think it was 23 at the time.
What year is this?
This was 2000.
Okay.
Actually, to be fair, when he first did it, it was 99. So it was right at the end of 99.
So Y2K was happening.
Y2K was happening. So I missed out on all of that stuff, which was great. just as Y2K started, it was that January that I joined onto it. So I missed the absolute gold rush of 99, which will forever be a regret for me. started into there and managed to squeak my way through the interview process and into a love affair with recruitment.
What were you recruiting for back then?
It was NT4 support professionals in Surrey.
What is an NT4 support professional?
Do you know what? That's a question which I wish no one would ever ask me.
Let's crack on to the next one then.
It was words you know about.
What were those early days like at S3?
Do you know what? I'll always be very nostalgic about the old days of recruitment, and I loved it. You know, I had a great time there. It was a private business. It was about 400 people, I think, in the group at that sort of stage. It was 13 different startups. We were the first person. I was the most experienced person because I turned up a day before everyone else in a startup. And we just basically ran at everything and had some great fun and managed to run pretty quickly with that business, right? Quite early. So
here's a left of field question for you. Out of those initial people that you worked with over the first few years, how many of them are running international recruitment firms right now?
Quite a few, actually. I met up with a couple of them the other day. It's that original group has got some businesses that have gone on to do some great things in it afterwards. So it was a guy called Mike Clinch, who I think works for Microsoft now in Norway, funnily enough. But he was a bit of a tyrant, really old school sort of sergeant major type recruiter, and he drilled us into knowing exactly what it took to do decent recruitment. And off the back of that, there's a number of different businesses that have come out and done really, really well out of it. So,
yeah, I think a large part of my client list is from that initial school of S3. And it just must have been a great breeding ground for competition to have brought that many entrepreneurs out of one catchment. It's just, it must be like an exception in the industry.
Well, do you know what it was? It was at that sort of stage, and what I think they got really right was they bred it right from, by the very nature that I was there as a graduate who'd never done recruitment as the first employee in a startup, kind of bred that whole thing, because the guy who I was reporting into had 5 years worth of recruitment experience and been given the opportunity to start his own business up with. There were 11, 12 different companies before that who'd gone down exactly the same route as well. And good people were given the opportunities to start. So, it was bred into you right from the very moment you came into that business. The whole thing was, if you do well, you can start a business. So the thing you wanted to do was start a business. So I think culturally, that's where it came from. And then as it floated and that opportunity didn't, is why so many of the people who would have been running businesses for S3 then moved on to do their own thing subsequently.
Yeah, really interesting. And we'll jump into that piece in a bit. So those were great early days that you were there, and you worked your way through the ranks. At what point did you decide to leave?
I think it was about 8.5 years in there. So I honestly, I never thought I'd leave that business. I loved it. We were successful. We had a great business within it. I love the people who I work with. But I also just had my first child. My second one, I think, was on the way, if not certainly on the horizon. And it was a PLC. And I think, what I wanted to do was do what I'd originally got into it was, which was be excited about that entrepreneurial lifestyle of actually starting something up. And at that stage, my view was, right, let's interview to get some backing to start up a business 8.5 years on. And I had a couple of opportunities to do that, which were presented with me. And then I also found that, against my will, I was introduced to a lady called Nicola Linkletter from Badenoch & Clark, and I never for a million, never for a million years thought I'd join another business like that. But Nicola was massively impressive and highlighted some of the sort of shortcomings I may have had at that sort of stage.
And tell me, what were they?
Well, we were quite one dimensional back then. It was a very aggressive sort of style of business, and whilst I'd run sales teams, I wasn't necessarily a business person at that sort of stage or operated on a higher level than maximizing the performance out of every individual in the business, which is a huge part of it. But there was also then running the P&Ls and looking at genuine business decisions around what they wanted to do. And she gave me an opportunity to come in there and look after the IT part of BNC. And it was honestly one of my best decisions that I think I ever made, because it gave me a completely different objective on how to do the job. And what I think we've tried to do here is take the best of both businesses, which is so contrasting, to provide something a little bit different between the two of them. The sort of enthusiasm and positivity and energy and story of S3 alongside the, the sort of velvet glove of a Badenoch & Clark, the client side and the culture I always thought it was they were very nice people to do business with for the clients. And I remember going to various different businesses, and it was a completely different reaction I got from one company to the other about how people saw you as a business. So my view was, is there was, at BNC, it probably lacked a little bit of the dynamism I was used to. And S3, that's a bit of the finesse that I wanted to be involved in. And I thought if you could put both of them together, you'd have a real opportunity to create something brilliant.
So, what age were you in 2010?
In 2010, it's asking me a question now, isn't it? I was early to mid 30s, so probably
early to mid 30s.
Yeah, 33, 34, or something like that. I think
two kids, a mortgage.
Yeah,
wife working?
No, she wasn't actually. No.
So still doing the kids thing.
Yeah.
You're living in London, so yeah. it's not cheap.
Yeah.
That's a big call to set up your own business.
It was, and I had to do it the right way. So my view was it's something which I always wanted to do, but I also had to make sure I could do it with the right sort of backing. That's where I sort of sat down with my father-in-law, who's a relatively successful entrepreneur, very successful entrepreneur, and looked and spoke to him about what it would look like. And he helped me for best part of 6 months sort of put together a business plan. And the view to it then was to sort of take that business plan out and put it on a roadshow and get investment. But the more we worked on it together, the more we realised actually we should keep this in the family. And we brought my brother-in-law in, and it gave me the cushion to be able to do what I knew we could do. I knew we could be successful with it because I knew that we had the right sort of people.
Let's jump into
but
that
I needed
business.
that sort of backing.
Let's jump into that business plan. What type of stuff, like if somebody was to sit down with you today and they were like, I want to set up a business.
Yeah.
I'm putting together a business plan for a recruitment company. What type of stuff did you put in place then? And what would you put in place now?
Do you know what? It's almost exactly the same sort of things now that I would do then. It's a very simple sort of formula of a two pager where you look at your costs and your likely costs and what you'd bring in and what you're gonna spend to get there. And the key thing for me was to overestimate the cost and to underestimate your return. And I think the hubris of a startup recruiter is you're going to be able to do X, Y, and Z straight away. And I took my initial sort of billings of what I thought we would be able to do and slashed them. And because of that, we hit them in 6 months and all the pressure was off. We were actually profitable within 4 months of starting up the business. We used less than a third of the initial investment that we had planned for it and didn't take it. And that gave us so much less pressure into it. It's also then to work out, I think beforehand you quite often think about money coming in and then fail to think about whether it drops out or whether there's going to be a delay in payment terms, et cetera, and the companies you're working with. So it's lots of that sort of minutiae that was really important. I think if I'd done that on my own straight away, I'd probably have overestimated and caused myself a few more problems. But the fact was that sort of, I guess, bizarrely for, which is completely against the sort of entrepreneurial mindset, a sort of pessimistic view was probably one of the best things that we could have looked at the time.
And okay, so putting the numbers together and doing all that, when it comes to maybe structuring where you're going to specialize in, how did you do that to navigate against any type of clauses that you had with your previous employer in terms of knocking after clients and candidates? And how did you pick a specific niche? And are you still doing the same niche now that you started with?
We are, absolutely, yes. Yeah. So I think that's one of the key parts of it. I think people get very tempted to move out and do as much as they can and just try and get money through the door. And we were always very keen to make sure we had something in there which we could become what we now call famous in the space for. So everything is about making sure that, in my view, you're famous in the space, you own a niche, and you sort of dominate to become the best in the world in that particular area. And that's very much the goal for what we want to do with Harrington Star. So we looked at it, and we've done that subsequently when we've launched other businesses through the group, is to look at areas there where we think there is high demand and a skill shortage and go off that. In fintech at that sort of stage, it's 2010, so we're still talking about the issues around the marketplace. There was a big move in electronic trading. There was a big investment still going into fintech, and there was a need to lose people across the business but invest in technology still. So I thought it was a good high-value marketplace. I thought it was a marketplace that had competition, but competition that was beatable within it. I thought it was something where you could be able to be successful within it. So that's how we looked at it. In terms of the competition aspect of what we wanted to do, we just walked away from everything we'd ever done before. So I'd worked in that marketplace, but I knew there was a big market behind it. And we were concerned about that. But what happened 6 months later is we actually ended up working with very few of the companies we'd worked with before, because we just found better ones alongside that.
Because the market in fintech, for anybody that doesn't know that, it's not the big banks, essentially. I know they have a bit of fintech in there, but it's a lot of smaller independent banks
There's a load of independent banks. There's also sort of the companies that provide the technology for the banks and challenge or support into that. Is it's a four-pronged area. There are the end users, so you look at asset managers, hedge funds, banks, and we look at the tech arms of those. Then there's the vendors, and then the consultancies, and then the startups and disruptors, which is a really interesting area.
Yeah, there's a great podcast in that space called FS11. I don't know if you've come across. Yeah, they're amazing. Okay, cool. So you've picked your niche. What are those early days like? Is it just you calling around, running around London? Have you hired two people to start at the same time as you?
There was four of us in a little room in Waterloo at the start of it. Right. So it's people who've been with me beforehand, and it was go out there, and that room was that room was brilliant. I loved it. It was zero, database, bullhorn database. It was completely empty of anyone, and we just got to work on picking up the phone and celebrating all of the tiny little wins. It was like we'd be punching the air. If someone would say we'd call back, it wasn't about we've got to do a deal or this, that, and the other. Let's attack it and it was and build something, and it was fantastic.
Did that become part of your culture then, celebrating little wins?
Absolutely, along the way? Yeah, and it always has been. I think it's a really important thing. I think sometimes people can sort of live or die by needing that sort of deal or the big the big picture stuff or anything like that. But there's loads of things that go well on a day in a recruiting business, and if you miss them, I don't think you I think you struggle a little bit.
Yeah, it's tough not to get too excited when things are going well, or to get too downhearted when they're not.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of trying to enjoy little bits of the process throughout the day, while keeping it all together and making sure you're getting your shit done.
That's it. Look, the mental side for me of this business is the key part of it. Whenever you look at anyone's issues, there'll be a mental, whether they're doing well or badly, it will be down to the mindset that they sort of bring into it. And I think, that sort of ability to keep to your process, to let the score take care of itself, so to speak, which is a sort of quote by a guy called Bill Walsh, who wrote a brilliant book on the subject. He was the San Francisco 49ers coach many years ago. And that's something which we sort of absolutely weave into the business. Look, focus on the process, don't focus on the results. Yeah. If you focus on the process, the results come after it.
And so you're amazingly, you're profitable after 4 months. You've got some serious heads in there in the first four people with you. They're all experienced. You're all doing well. Did you have a vision at that stage that you would scale out a business that has done what it's done? Did you put it in your plan that I'm going to have X amount of people by a certain time, or did you have a way of saying whenever we get to this billing threshold we will then hire somebody?
We knew what we wanted to do, and we sort of had rough figures of where we wanted to be within 3 years, so right from the very start we had a three-year plan of the numbers we'd have, the numbers we've been doing, and the number of people we need to get there. But we also said in the first year we'd try and just be four people and build up a well over that sort of period, which then would allow us to bring people in. But that was the part of the thing that changed, because we hit the target by the first 6 months, and then started to bring people in after that.
And I'm guessing you're also experienced there, and you all know each other really well, and you're working intimately. So there's a lot of autonomy in an environment like that. When you bring new people into a business and fresh people into the industry, you must have had to have structured something and put it in place. How did that go about, and what was the kind of early learnings that you got from it?
Yes, so we decided that we've been successful because we had four people, and then six people who we knew. Everyone knew each other in that initial six people, and then we said, right, we're going to start now building people in who've never done the job before, and getting them right in the industry. And I thought, right, there is at the same time my sister-in-law's then boyfriend had just got a job at PwC. And I was thinking, right, PwC gets a great reputation. And he was working on the fold-up of birthdays, I think, the card shop. And I was thinking, right, he's a grad and he's getting that. And they get a great reputation for excellence. And the recruitment industry gets panned for their graduates doing the same sort of job. And I thought, why is that? And then I spoke to him. And I talked about the training he was getting. I talked about the exams that he had to pass to get into it. And I thought, there isn't any of that whenever I've been in a recruitment thing. It's like, here's the phone. Here's a bit of training. I get on with it. And so we thought, right, let's have a structured plan and build a sort of university program, which we called the Harrington Style University Program, which allowed people to come in there, and whether they'd had experience or not, they'd be able to have a formula our process of how to do the job. And before we brought those people in, we sat down and we wrote an 800-page manual of how to do the job to maximise your earnings within it. So everything we knew, every single aspect of the job. And that became a sort of modularised programme and a document that everyone got it. So you had this massive, great file. This is pre-iPad days,
yeah.
which we gave to people. And they would have 800 printed pages of this is how you do the job. And they'd read that. Then they come in and they get a course delivered by one of the four of us on each aspect of each module of it. They then have to do, and this was the important part of it, they didn't have to pass a test. And they'd have to get a 65% pass mark, and they'd have to work pretty hard once they were in there to keep learning and to make sure that learning was going in, and then to deliver it and have a tick list of everything they wanted to do once they were in the business. And I think that sort of ability to sort of have the Harrington style process, sort of running through them right from the very start of it was critical for us.
I'm guessing that's evolved as the years have gone on.
Yeah. But it's still very much the same sort of the same fundamentals. I believe in brilliant basics, and I think if you get the basics right, and the whole thing came down to excellence or understanding, and really sort of understanding the needs of clients and customers, and based around five different keys in the job, if you can keep those things as the fundamental part of what you do, and then put some magic touches on top of it, then you're going to be successful.
What are those things?
So the five keys are world-class qualification of job, world-class qualification of candidate, attract, engage, and retain the right clients, attract, utilize, and maximize the right candidates, and build your brand.
Okay. What does an average team meeting look like for you when you're kicking off the week?
So funny enough, we do it every day. Rather than be a sort of massive month, a weekly kickoff, I'll take this back a little bit further. About 2012, I got a very interesting customer service, and I started reading about the best customer service businesses in the world. And the name that kept on coming up over and over again was the Ritz-Carlton Group. So I thought I'd go and have a doorstop the Ritz and see if I could speak to them about their service. Got told that they couldn't do that. And so I wrote a little stinky email about their service to them. And I got a call from the GM, who then said, look, come in and have a chat. So he spent 2 hours with me and spoke to me about every aspect of the Ritz's service and how they stand out as a luxury brand effectively. And what he said was important, and Ritz is a sister company as opposed to part of the Ritz-Carlton, but the Ritz-Carlton are famous for having something which they call the lineup, which is every day they talk about a story of customer success and where someone's done a great job from all over the world. So it could be Indonesia or Mexico or wherever it may be. And that people will try and strive to be involved in that story, and they'll do that. So it reinforces the stories of excellence within the business. What then happens after that is they'll then talk about a few of the key things and keep everyone informed in what's going on in the business, and they'll go out and execute it there afterwards. So we said, right, we're going to do a lineup, and every morning at 8:30 for the last 5 years, 5-6 years now, we've had someone different stand up in front of everyone in the business and do a 5-minute training piece about what best practice looks like. Then off the back of that, we'll talk through some of the key things that we've got to focus in on as a business. The whole thing takes about 5-10 minutes, but it's every single day without fail. And then we have something which we call star moments, which is where we recognize someone. You've got the opportunity to give someone 10 points across the business who's helped you out or shown any of those the five values of the business in action across the company. So again, enthuses people to recognize each other's success, to feel recognized for it, and to do that sort of thing as well. And then we'll celebrate deals that have been happening the day before.
Can you spot somebody who's going to be good at recruitment?
Hopefully. So I think on this, we've done a lot of work on it over the last couple of years, because it's your most important asset, and if you could bring people into it, it's critical. And we've formalized it now into looking at three things: the person, the professional, and the recruiter. And the more I've looked at this over what's now 19 years, the more I think that the people who are good in recruitment come down to that first cardinal, which is people. If you've got a good person, you can work with everything else. And that's we've got a number of different indicators of that. Then it's a good professional, so someone who wants to learn, someone who looks the part, someone who wants to be the part, someone who's passionate about being the best they can be in the industry. And then the recruiter is someone who can connect, put people together, know their stuff, has the ability to be credible with their client base. So I think they're, in that formula of person, professional, and recruiter, you can definitely find them and weave out what good looks like. And then we think there's four different people who become a top biller, and that will, and they'll probably all have a little bit of one of these four, but they generally will lean to one part of it, which is the grafter, the person who's just there to work really, really hard. The competitor, the person who has to win and is super motivated and everything they've done. That's the classic sort of ex-sportsman or something like that that you're seeing something before. Then you've got the connector, so the person who's the sort of fulcrum of the pub and all that sort of stuff, but is able to have that internal database to put people together. And then actually you've got the thinker, which I think is a less noticeable top biller trait, but it's something there which has been really, really important for us, which is having people who are really interested in their marketplace, credible in what they want to do. They aren't necessarily the extrovert, they might be the introvert, but they'll be very, very good at sort of reading a situation and trying to put people together off the back of that.
Fantastic. That's a more detailed answer than I'm used to getting.
We put a lot of work into it because I just thought it was to me, your business succeeds or fails based off the people you've got into it, particularly in recruitment. And we didn't want to make mistakes on this sort of stuff. We wanted to have the best possible people. I'm really proud that a load of the people who were there in the start are here now, and I want to be with right the way through the journey. And I think if you can, the more effort you can put into that sort of process and you really understand what good and great looks like, the more likely you are to find good and great from that.
So you've put a lot of work into social media. How do you get a recruiter to structure their day in between being building their own personal brand online, but yet still doing the traditional activities that we need to do in order to make placements and get in front of people and do all of that? What does that look like now? Because it's obviously changed even since I got into recruitment in 2011.
Yeah. You know, I think it's very much part of the process. So I think, people say, how do you make it into their sort of almost KPIs by the base of that? So that's essentially, building your brand is a core KPI. It's one of the five things that we train people on as the five keys of the job. And for me, it's about, your brand, your personal brand, or your company brand, or whatever it is your air force to the infantry. So they should be the thing which you're able to put to call in to do that sort of stuff. And if you're asleep and your brand's out there working for you, and you're front of mind every time a candidate wants to move or a client wants to hire because they've seen the useful content that you're in, it makes your job easier. So I think that recruitment consultants are looking for any opportunity to make their job easier. And as long as you present the sort of real benefits to the features that you're giving to them, of which to me social media and brand absolutely is, then it becomes part of the very DNA of the business. And I think now that's that sort of push on that has become an essential part of who we are.
We used to hide IP as recruiters. We used to like take pride in our database, and nobody else has a database like us. Nobody knows our clients like we know. But now we're kind of entering an age where we're sharing our clients' details online, we're interviewing them, where we're showing that our brand works alongside their brand, and you're a proponent of that, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it's we thought long and hard about this for a while. I remember
it's a big question, right?
Yeah, it was one of those things where we were saying, oh, look, if we showcase a client out there, someone else is going to deal with it. So everyone gets very worried about their data and databases and people nicking the database when they go and all that sort of stuff. But look, every bit of information on who you're working with is open to the public now with LinkedIn and Google and everything like that. There's no great secret that you found a company there that no one else is going to be working with. You're going to have competition, and my view comes down to what's best for the customer. And I think if you take a mindset of what's the best thing you can do for your customer, you're going to be in a situation where you're in the best possible position to help them. So we started to think about ourselves as a growth business, and the first part of that is growing teams. That what we're paid for is growing our customers' teams by putting good people into their business. But then what we thought we could also do was to be of value and be of service, which is where Your Success Our Business comes from, which is one of our strap lines in the company. And Your Success Our Business means growing their brands and growing their networks. So if a client works with us, whether they work with us or they don't work with us, we want to build a community within that fintech space that allows them to be better from being part of that. which means they then start to know our business. Then off the back of that, they start to like our business, and then they start to trust it, and then they start to buy from us, and then refer us ultimately from there on, from there onwards.
So we're not the traditional car salesman, and we're adding value.
Exactly. I mean, it's been a big passion of mine. But you know, I love the industry, and you know, I get on the soapbox quite a lot about this particular subject. Is that, you know, you can look at lawyers, and you can look at accountants, and you can look at management consultants as the other professional services that you'll see in the paper under the listed companies, and you'll see recruitment as this sort of run to the litter alongside that. But my view is you know you've got a great accountant, it's important. You've got a great lawyer, it's important. But they're not going to change the absolute DNA of your business. And if you've got someone there who's a partner who can give you access to the very best people and help you push your business forward by getting A players into your company, the very best people for your business, that's got to be the most important professional service to work with. And it really grinds my gears a little bit when I hear the industry look down on, because I think it's just such an important part of the economy. And I think it's starting to grow, and I think it's starting to professionalise. And why it didn't was because you had a load of people chucking mud at a wall, some really questionable sort of routes to marketplace. So what we've been trying to do right from day one is to sort of provide a service that makes people sort of raise their eyebrows and think, that's better than I expected. Do you know what I mean? That's a service that sort of stands out. And that's where the magazines come into play for us. That's where the TV comes into play for us. That's where the events come into play. And we've brought 300 senior people together completely free for them to look at leadership and have a panel of people from sport, the military and business talk about what great leadership looks like. And they leave there with value. And what's happened on that is hundreds and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pounds worth of revenue as a byproduct from people there who start to know and like our business off the back of it.
And you're obviously a guy that reaches out for knowledge. And you mentioned some of the books that you've read. Do you use any type of recruitment services out there to network with other people, or like with your peers, or do you have any mentors yourself, or how does that work for you?
So I mentioned at the start of it, my father-in-law, who's been really sort of important to me as a sort of I guess, you know, as a non-exec who hasn't had anything within the industry, and I think that's been really important to us that we haven't looked always within the industry to recreate it, which I think sometimes is the issue in that sort of space. I've been fortunate enough to be in it for 19 years, and there's loads of people there I've talked to. There's a couple of guys from Arrows Group when they first started, now ICG Medical, Adrian and James, who were hugely supportive of me when I first started up and give me loads of information, and still do now, about what they've done and the sort of journey that they've gone through from a startup to a 120 million turnover group through to the split of the two businesses there afterwards. I've got various different people across the industry who've achieved some great things, who are always very kind with their time to me, which I then try to be in return to companies who are moving through at the same sort of stage now with it as well. So the thing I love about it now is it's a much more collaborative industry than it's ever been before. And I think you quite often go to places. I've been to friendly with James Osborne, who's invited me occasionally to the recruitment network, and very happy to sort of speak to to the guys there and help out with some of the development they've done. It's such a collaborative space, and there's so much many things that we can learn from each other within that.
Yeah, previous guest on this podcast.
Yeah, great guy.
Yeah, great guy. So that's all really interesting. When I look at the fintech world, and I look at your business, I'd be looking at where are the hubs in the world where fintech is exploding, and there's about five or six of them. What does the future hold for Harrington Star and the other brands that you're creating throughout it?
Yeah, so look, I'm excited about international growth. I'm also excited about domestic growth, and I think you've got to make sure you're looking at both aspects of that, because sometimes certainly at S3 at one stage, I think all the options came up that it was going to be New York or Holland or Europe or wherever it was from there, and it sort of failed to have quite such an exciting career opportunity for London and the UK. And I want to make sure we learn from that. I want to make sure that people here who want to develop their career in London have a great opportunity to do that with different brands and businesses and sectors that they can move into as well. But my goal has always been a multinational, multi-brand, multi-niche business. that looks at a group of companies that can grow through. That's what I learned at S3, and I think it's a brilliant and unbroken way of doing business and creating opportunity for people within that group. So we started in New York 2 years ago. That's been a wonderful story so far. I'm really excited about their growth. That's gone out to San Francisco, where North Star's gone out there. North Star's our commercial CNI business that looks at technology within data, cyber, software and sales. So I'm excited about the growth out that both there and in New York and San Francisco. I like the look of Europe, and I like the look of Asia for Harrington Star as well. So it'll be people driven. We'll look to see the right people and make good opportunities and investments in the right ambition that we see.
All right, very exciting. And if anybody's listening to this, how can they reach out to you? And who should reach out to you?
Yeah, look, I'm always happy to speak to anyone, which is there. But look, we're hiring nonstop at the moment, and there's a lot of opportunity this year, both in London and the US. So we'd love to hear from people who are doing that. I'd love to hear from people who are looking to build their teams in any of the areas we've spoken about beforehand as well. And look, I'm always very happy to speak to people if they want to hear about any of the things, the mistakes we've made or the things we've done well or whatever helps them out in their journey. Because I've had, as I say, I've been really lucky with some of the people who've been supportive all the way through so far. So look, toby.babb@harringtonstar.com. That's the address.
All right. Thanks very much, Toby. What a fantastic interview.
Been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Great stuff. Talk soon.
Will do. Thanks a lot, mate.
What an amazing guest. Fantastic interview with Toby Babb. He really knows his stuff, and he's a real deal, right? He's set up a scalable business, used old school practices, mixed them with modern social practices, confident enough to put in employer branding techniques where he's just sharing who his clients are and saying, hey, we're this good. We'll tell you who our clients are. We're contingent. We'll work with you to make it happen. And, it's obviously working. I like the way he has a clarity in his vision, in how they induct people, how they train people, how that looks in terms of using what he got from S3. And if any of you don't know how S3 work, it's a divide and conquer model where you become a specialist in a niche, you hire a load of other ones who train under you, you then prove yourself, and then they say, okay, set up this in another location, you get that shot, and then you go and scale and do that, and you use McDonald work mechanisms where, this is the systemized process that we use. We all work the same way. And as a result, we can do the same activities and work backwards to guarantee the same result. Now, he's doing that with a softer edge and using more modern techniques and a more consultative approach from what he was taught. So that's what he was talking about when he was talking about taking some of the finesse from Badenoch and Clark with some of the business processes of S3. So look, if you're enjoying these podcasts, reach out to me like somebody did today. And I got a phone call today, really made my day. Guy who's just based in an office by himself, doing well, running a great wee business, wondering how he can scale up his business, asking me lots of questions on it, which, maybe I'm not qualified to answer, but I can definitely impart any of the learnings that I've had from interviewing people like Toby. And really enjoying getting to speak to these people. And I'm going to keep on smashing out the podcasts every second day, every day if I can. And keep telling me what you need me to ask the experts in our space so I can help you scale your business. And we will be back next week. So until then, see you and have a great week. Go out and get some, make some money, enjoy yourself. Take care. God bless.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.